Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Margot Kaminsky, JB Rubin, Evan Brown, and me. We're going to talk about Redigi, Aereo, drones, and naughty ads about your mom. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 205, recorded April 5th, 2013. Trains, transporters, and WonkaVision. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell and I am so excited for this week's show. The courts have been giving us very interesting things to talk about, as have local law enforcement. And we've got some great folks to hash through these issues today. We've got Jamie Rubin joining us from Info Law Group. He's a colleague of Evan's, and he has been writing a lot and paying attention to the updates to the FTC disclosure guidelines. So we're going to get into that too. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm great, and it's wonderful to have you here with us today. Also joining us from Yale's Information Society Project, where she is the executive director, is Margot Kaminsky. Hello, Margot.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We were talking before the show. The Yale Information Society Project has been a huge influence on me. Margot was saying it just celebrated its 15th anniversary, so started in 97, and has always been just an amazing source for all things related to technology law, great analysis, and paying attention to the important issues. So thanks for your great work there.
Thank you, guys. We like to think that we're behind most major academics who work in law and technology. Our alumni list is kind of crazy.
You want a name drop for us?
No. I'll let you guys use the internet.
All right. Who's Jack Balkin was there, right? Wasn't he the head for a while, way back
Jack
in the day?
Jack is our faculty founder, so he still is the faculty head and the director, and he is a First Amendment professor at Yale Law School, for those of you who do not know who he is.
Yes. Balkanization is his blog that is just about as old as the Yale Information Society Project. So go check that out. He's always writing great stuff. And someone else who remembers Jack Balkin back in the day is Evan Brown. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy Friday. Hope everything's going well with you. This is this should be an awesome conversation. I've been looking forward to it all week.
I know, me too. The courts have been very generous to us lately with some really interesting decisions. So let's get into them. Let's start on the copyright front. So folks who've been listening to the show recently will remember that we hashed through the Supreme Court's decision in Kurtzsang that dealt with the first sale doctrine as to textbooks that were imported into the United States from Thailand, bought much more cheaply there and then sold more cheaply here. And the first sale doctrine was found to apply to that kind of a situation, so that even though that meant it was difficult for publishers to sort of play the geographical markets and price things differently in one place than they did in others and expect to reap all the benefits of that, the Supreme Court found that was just fine, and the first sale doctrine should apply to those physical books. Now we've had a decision out of a district court. That's the federal trial court level. In the Redigi case, we've talked about Redigi before. Redigi is an online site where you could take your legally purchased iTunes songs and resell them if you no longer wanted to listen to them. They came up with technology that they thought would pass legal muster because it would enable you to, quote unquote, transfer your songs to them. They were then deleted from your hard drive and you were unable to listen to them again. So you would think that there might be something to that, that they might have gotten somewhere. And this case is far from over, but the district court, in deciding motions for summary judgment brought by both the parties, decided that Redigi was out of luck and that this was copyright infringement, infringed the reproduction rights and distribution rights of Capitol Records, who was the plaintiff in the case, and also that the fair use defense did not apply and that the first sale doctrine did not apply in this instance. So although books were okay, because of the way technology works and the way you have to make copies of digital files in order to do what Redigi was doing, the court said Redigi was out of luck. So I'm sure that won't be the end of this case, and we will probably see more analysis of these issues at the appellate court level. But that's where things stand now, and it's a fascinating decision where Redigi was arguing that their technology, they used some great metaphors. They tried to tell the court that it was when you uploaded your file to Redigi, it was like you put it on a train. It was like a transporter from Star Trek. It was like Wonka Vision from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. There's some great metaphors in this decision. But actually, I think they were kind of trying to put one over on the court when they were characterizing their service that way, because as the court actually discerned, copies were made. And the fact that existing copies were wiped from the user's hard drive after they sold their goods didn't really get them around the copyright issue. The court acknowledged that maybe this should be a situation where the first sale doctrine applied, but the court can't do anything to change the Copyright Act. And under its terms, as the court read them, this was unauthorized copying and had to be infringement. Evan, do you think that the court got that right?
Well, you're right in observing it's right there where the decision really, really hangs on the fact that there are additional copies being made. And I think the decision is pretty easily reconcilable with the Kerstang decision from a couple of weeks ago, whenever that is, because what we've got to look at when we're considering, at least in the first sale context, is whether these copies were lawfully made under the Copyright Act. And no matter what metaphor you try to use, whether it be Star Trek or Willy Wonka or just, you know, ordinary railroad metaphor, you're not going to be able to get around the essential fact that copies are made in order to do this transfer that's articulated or that's, you know, that's accomplished through the Redigi service. So no matter how hard you try, you can't factually, equate what's going on here with what is going on in the distribution of actual physical textbooks. Now, whether that actually makes sense on a practical level is an entirely different question. And it really, that irreconcilability of the law and the factual reality and the good sense that it makes is really what underscores a discussion that one should be having as to whether copyright law as it's written still makes sense in the digital context. We're still operating under the constructs of copyright law that have been with us for, you know, 200 or so, or 200 or more years, really, in the digital context. So it's great to see situations like this that where you get results that may not make sense on a practical level and kind of leave one scratching his or her head about this. But when you look at the law, it's pretty clear that, the court's decision was based on a pretty sound reading of the Copyright Act and what it requires.
The court, too, recognized that there is a difference between physical goods and digital goods, and that when you make a copy of a physical good, or actually when you have an original physical good, it's going to degrade over time. You know, books are going to get dog-eared and worn out and split bindings and everything else. But digital copies are just the same as the original, and they don't degrade. So in IRC... where was that comment just a second ago? Mark M904 said, I'm going to take this copy of the original that I totally did not make a backup of and sell it to you. And that was part of the problem. I mean, the court didn't put it that way, but their reasoning was going there. Margo, I think we all think that the court was kind of hamstrung here by the Copyright Act, and that the court kind of punted it to Congress and said, look, you know, if this is a wrong outcome, Congress has to change the way the act works. But as it reads now, this is what we're stuck with. Do you think that will go anywhere?
You mean, do I think Congress will end up taking on digital for sale. I'm not sure. I mean, I think the biggest place where this is going to play out, there are two places where this is going to play out in interesting ways. One actually intersects nicely with the Aereo case, and the other has to do with digital libraries, right? So as many people know, if you're a library and you're operating in the online space, instead of buying a book that's secondhand, or instead of getting books and not worrying about getting their licenses, you'll couple with an institution like Amazon and license books that you then lend to your readers. So there have been these sort of private market ways of getting around the fact that there's no digital for sale. And whether Congress takes on for sale and makes digital for sale, I think will have to do with how much people can show that institutions we really socially value, such as libraries or secondhand bookstores, are suffering from a lack of digital for sale. I don't think a redigi is going to prompt a digital for sale act. And the second half of the thing about redigi that I think is interesting when you look at Aereo is that this has pretty big implications for cloud computing, right? So if anytime we transfer an item online, we're in fact making a reproduction of it, and that reproduction is copyright infringement, then we end up with a big problem anytime we try to back something up online. So it's one thing to say, I as a user have my iTunes song and can't sell that to another user. And it's another thing to say, I as a user have my iTunes song and can't put that somewhere as backup or put it into some kind of new format. So I think that's where the Aereo split happens, and that's where you might get more successful pushback against potential implications for the reproduction part of the redigi case.
Well, it seems like the court tried to dodge that issue and didn't have to reach it, because Capitol Records did not contest when redigi argued that uploading to and downloading from its cloud locker service for storage and personal use were protected fair use. Capitol didn't go there. It said only that uploading and downloading from the cloud locker incident to sale was outside of fair use. So it seems like this could actually be good news for cloud locker services, don't you think?
Yeah, but the court's language about the distribution is reproduction is pretty worrisome, right? Because anytime you distribute something online, that ends up being reproduction, and what constitutes distribution isn't really particularly clearly defined in the case. So yes, Capitol didn't push for saying that backup is a copyright violation, but the court's language about distribution and reproduction leaves that question open, I think.
The other thing that the court got to, it got to the point where it was needing to say, okay, well, we're not saying there's no for sale right for digital goods, but the phono record that you're entitled to resell is the actual bits written on hard drive on your machine. And if you can resell that, then the for sale doctrine will apply to you. So the court actually talked about iPods and, you know, a computer hard drive that was loaded up with music, and said that it didn't think there was a problem with reselling that kind of machine. So I don't think that we're going to see a huge boom in loaded up iPods or iPhones being resold. But it is a question that we've asked on the show before. You know, is it legal to do that? And the court here seems to have thought that would be okay. Jamie, do you think we'll see any fallout from that?
I don't see that as a necessary fallout, given that you can back to the physical product. I mean, you can sell back your CDs to a music store for resale. That is, again, the physical product issue. So selling your hard drive, I see, is a very similar issue. And back to Margot's point about the sale of Margot was saying something about what was Margot's last point? Can you remind me?
Her very last point had to do with whether distribution is copyright infringement.
Yes, and I think the court didn't or Capitol didn't need to go there, or didn't want to go there, given that there is this I guess, generally accepted practice of, you know, me putting my making a tape, not anymore, a CD or a copy for purposes of playing it in my car. That would really have destroyed that right, which I think Capitol didn't want to go there, given that we are all their customers.
Got it. So, Evan, I think this leaves the world open for a business model that actually matches what Redigi argued theirs was, if it can be technologically done. And this brings up another great metaphor from the case. Redigi, at some point in their briefing, was talking about decoupaged cards. I don't know if you're familiar with this art form. But it's a Texas case, an old Texas case they were referring to, where you take a greeting card and you somehow chemically remove the image from the front of the greeting card. And then you could put it on, you know, a box or an egg or something. You've created a new work from the image on the card. And the court in Texas said, that's okay. You know, you're not making a copy. You're taking the same thing and using it in a new way, putting it in a new place. You've already purchased it, so that's fine. So Redigi argued that's what they were doing, but they weren't. You know, what they were doing was the same thing that happens when you upload a photo from your hard drive to Facebook or Flickr or some online service where you want to display it. You're uploading it, you're giving them a copy, but it's still staying on your hard drive. Now, Redigi would take the extra step and erase it, but, you know, a copy was still made. If a business model could be come up with where, you know, you could Wonka vision the bits off your hard drive and onto a cloud locker service, first of all, do you think such a thing is possible? Secondly, do you think someone will go there?
Well, I guess I have a hard time convincing myself that something like that could really be possible. And maybe I can't even go so far as to entertain the issue all that much, because what do you mean by doing Wonka vision of the bits? How is that any different than just taking that, configuration or that constellation of zeros and ones that comprise the bits, you know,
right,
to stick with your example of the image? I mean, that's going to be the exact, binary sequence, whether it's on your hard drive or the other side. So I think that there is a fundamental obstacle that can't be overcome here without some change to the Copyright Act, because it is no longer the same physical medium. And I'm not saying that makes sense, you know, hearkening back to what I said in my first comments, but that is what it is. You know, Redigi is kind of like the decoupage examples, and it's kind of not like that, because it is like the decoupage example, which found, you know, that was an okay under the fair use doctrine, because you are dispossessed of your original ability to use the work. You can't send it as in the conventional sense as a greeting card anymore once it's been decoupaged onto a decorative tile or something like that, in much the same way that Redigi's service dispossesses you of the access or the ability to access that file on your local hard drive. But at the same time, it's not the same thing that is being used elsewhere, anywhere else in the world, you know, where somebody else could get that series of bits. So that's why it's, you know, that's certainly what makes it interesting to talk about. It certainly what underscores the kind of weirdness of the outcome with copyright. But if there can be some kind of magic, it reminds me of that cartoon where, you know, it's those scientists up at the blackboard, you know, there's all these formulas, and then step two is, and then a miracle occurs, and then there's some more thing over here, and the caption says, I think you need to be a little bit more specific in this middle step. I would suggest, Denise, maybe if you can be a little more specific in that, whatever you're saying is this new Wonka vision way of distributing digital files from one place to the other, with it still being the same, you know, metaphysically grounded bits, then, you know, we might be onto something. But I have to, you know, kind of just use some fanciful imagination to get to that.
No, it would take someone with a lot more technological chops than I have to figure that out, because every time I try and think through it, I get to, okay, so you have to copy and erase just as they were doing.
Right.
So I don't know that it's possible, but it's, you know, if it is, someone get out there, get your VC funding and go forth. Margo, any further thoughts on Redigi before we move on?
I mean, I think that the scenario that you're discussing is precluded by the court's language about the particular copy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't, the court envisions that moment where the copy appears somewhere else as being a reproduction. So the instant it appears somewhere else, you're already dealing with copyright law because it's no longer the particular copy that you started with. So as long as we have Redigi's language on the books, even with Wonka Vision or whatever your technology was, there would be no digital for sale. I think the one thing I wanted to talk about is sort of the consequences to innovation of having this Kurt Sang Redigi 1-2 combo, because it seems very strange to me, right? You're basically, the courts are creating a situation where those who want to use the first sale right have to operate in the offline world. And those that sell content products want to do that online now and probably want to do it as a license and not a sale. So the tension between those two things, I think, is going to play out in really interesting ways. I think you had one of the readings was this textbook rental company, right?
Right.
That's an example of how this might play out, right? So if you're a content provider and you think that anything that you produce in the real world is going to be subject to first sale, then logically you'll probably make it pretty expensive because you're not going to reap a second sale from it. And if you're the consumer and you're in that world, you're going to try to resell that, or you're going to try to create a secondary market that's innovative that will allow people to share the overpriced content good.
Right. So let's bring people up to speed on what we're talking about. There's an article in our discussion points for the show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/205 about a company called Zoogl in Australia. And it is much like what companies like Chegg and others in the United States are doing. And that is giving people the option to rent textbooks rather than buy them. So I actually stuck this in our copyright discussion, but it maybe does not belong there. The Zoogl people are arguing, they're sort of saying, hey, it's not fair. The publishers are not selling to us on the same basis they would other booksellers. Well, duh. I mean, the publishers aren't real happy they exist. The publishers don't have to do business with particular booksellers, you know, unless they're in some sort of monopoly situation and there are antitrust considerations coming into play that regulators would want to get involved in. They can sell to whoever they want to at whatever prices they want to. So, you know, these folks are in the situation where they could go out and buy the books and then resell them, but not in any sort of preferential wholesale arrangement if that's not what the publishers want. So they're kind of complaining about that, but it's a very interesting development that these services even exist because, as you say, Margot, this is in response to, you know, the expensive market for the item in the first instance. So, I don't know, you want to try and tie this back into our Redigi discussion or anything further to add about textbook rental services?
Right. So I think that the textbook rental is an example of what happens in the real world if, as a consequence of allowing for sale in the real world, you have really high-priced goods, right? You're going to find innovative ways to both create secondary markets and create rental markets to get around the fact that publishers are responding to real-world first sale by making the good really high-priced. Because one of the reasons why textbooks are so expensive is because there are secondary markets. I actually think it's great that there are secondary markets in the real world. But so to tie it into Redigi, you're going to have a big split between what happens offline and what happens online because of the difference between Kurt Sang and Redigi. Offline, you're going to have expensive books that are sold and consumers trying to innovate to make those books less expensive, either on resale or rental. And online, you're going to have licensing agreements where you don't own anything that you think you've purchased.
Got it. Well, yes, I too love secondary markets like this. In fact, when I read about Zoogl and these other textbook rental services, I was reminded that this year our family rented skis for the season. You know, rather than going out and buying them, there's a small little ski and snowboard shop near where we live that they'll rent them to you for the season for less than you would pay for a new pair of skis. And then you bring them back. And then the next year, I'm not sure if we get any break if you rent them year over year. But if you, you know, just don't want to go to the trouble of buying the more expensive skis and you just need skis to ski on, they're taking care of that. And I don't think that they are arguing that the ski manufacturers should be giving them any more preferential pricing because they're buying in bulk and then renting them out. But we will have to see if these Zuckel people have any success with that. And I think we better make golden ticket our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you are listening to the show and a member of a profession where you might be able to get some continuing legal education credit, we have lots of information for you about doing that over at the TWIT Wiki. Find the TWIL page and go from there. So let's move on. We've referred to the Aereo case. Let's take a trip to the entertainment realm and talk about it. Okay, another big case, still pending in the trial court. But unlike Redigi, Aereo got a decision that says they can stay in business. The networks were trying to shut it down, had sought a preliminary injunction, and the court said, no way. Aereo seems to have found a way to allow people to subscribe and pay $12 a month to watch live television. They don't need to be paying fees to the networks. At least at this juncture, nobody has demonstrated that that has to be the case. There will still be a trial in this case where the record will be more fully developed and more arguments and evidence will come in, and maybe the networks will be able to show that. But at this juncture, the court has not been convinced that the Aereo service should be shut down. So for anyone who hasn't been paying attention to this decision, there have been a few of these services out there. IVI.TV was shut down, but their technology did not track Aereo's. Aereo is the one that has done this creative thing where they have hundreds and hundreds of tiny little dime-sized antennas in an array somewhere, you know, hopefully in a cool building. There we go. That's what they look like. Little antennas and big racks of them. And each user of the service gets assigned their very own antenna. So rather than having the big rabbit ears on their house, they pay $12 a month. They have their own little antenna and they can then use the service. I'm not a user, so I'm not sure exactly what devices you can use it on, but I'm assuming, you know, for your $12 a month, you not only can watch on your computer, but on mobile devices as well. And it's a big deal for people who don't want to have cable service. You know, if they want to have news and sports and things that you can't get on something like Netflix or Amazon, this would be a very nice fill-in service. So Aereo for the time being is still alive. Evan, what's your prognosis, doctor?
Well, I mean, it looks like it seems like the decision makes sense. You know, and interestingly enough, we didn't have to get into things like fair use, you know, because it's easy to start thinking of like, well, this is like space shifting or something like that. At least, and I think it's important to remind ourselves that this is, you know, not a definitive, you know, ruling on this, but it is pretty important, given that this is a denial of a summary judgment motion. So what the court is finding is, as a matter of law, based on the facts that are in the record now, there's no copyright infringement going on here. So clearly it's a validation for at least some form of innovation that's going on here. And it you can look at the decision as falling pretty clearly within the lines of what copyright provides for, because you've got the signal coming into a particularized antenna, even though it's small, dime-sized and all that, because it's going to one user, because it's not like a public distribution, but ostensibly it's for the personal consumption of this subscriber. There really is no fundamental distinction to be made between that and having the antenna on your roof. So, you know, it seems eminently sensible in that respect. So I guess at this point I'm left to wonder how things could change if this does go to trial, given the fact that the court has ruled, you know, in the summary judgment motion that this is what the law is, and these facts don't present, you know, anything that makes it not worth going to a trial. I'm you know, would be interested in seeing, you know, if this does go to trial, if there isn't some kind of license arrangement come up with here, or what could really change factually to make the conclusion different.
Jamie, Dwayne Knight in IRC is asking, wouldn't this constitute a public performance, just like in the Zadiva case, which we talked about a while ago on the show? But the court here found no, that when you're using your own little private antenna, that's a private performance that's just going to you. Do you think that the court is on good footing there?
Right. Well, as Barry Diller said it in a recent interview, the second that Radio Shack starts charging its customers a transmission fee for the when they purchase their antennas from Radio Shack, he'll start paying transmission fees as well. And to put it in that context, I think they got it right that it wasn't a public performance. I do think it's interesting, differing from the Radio Shack situation, however, is that I have to assume I don't own my little dime-sized antenna when I stop paying my subscription fees. That may not be a legal a distinction without a difference, but it is in fact a difference. But I agree with the court here from that particular vantage.
All right, Virgil wants to know in IRC whether this affects people who have antennas, their own antennas for receiving TV over the air. And no, this doesn't have any impact whatsoever on your own rabbit ears. It's just extending the rights that you have to have rabbit ears and pull down signals over the air to a third party service who's going to manage the antenna for you and make it really tiny. Margo, what are your thoughts on this one?
I think this case is really cool. It basically enables users to access things that shows that they would be able to access on TV for free anyway, but do it at their own leisure and from the device of their choice. So the court did a very good job of deciding to view this from the perspective of a user rather than the perspective of, say, Fox, ABC, or NBC, and say, you know, if you're able to. Again, it wasn't a fair use case, as Evan points out. But if you're able to watch TV at home and you're able to record something on your VCR and watch it later, then why shouldn't you be able to functionally do the same thing through a digital service?
Right. And you're referring to the Cablevision case as another stepping stone to
get to Sony where we Betamax are? And then Cablevision and then this. Yep.
Right.
It's just like a little miniature city of antennas that just happens to be somewhere else rather than the antenna being on your roof. It's like you just delegate a little part of yourself to exist in a data center. It's kind of weird.
Right, and the way they built it is so smart. I mean, they did it in a way that really, it does actually like physically replicate what you would be doing at home anyway, which again is another point about innovation, right? If you build the law in one way, innovation will build around it to try to fit into a gap in the law, and I think they did a good job of that with Aereo.
That's what also, I love about their service is that the only reason it exists as it does is because they read the law and decided, okay, we can do it this way, right?
Yes. And I also, just as a side note, love the fact that these antennae keep getting referred to as little rabbit ears. Right. If you're going to build a technology, you might as well make the name cute.
Yes.
And they should really make them look like little rabbit ears. Wouldn't it then just taken the cake if they'd have been like little ears or something, you know? Or you know, like the I was thinking like the old Moonrakers, you know, like those antennas, you know, that were like really big going up into the sky, you know, for like CB radio and stuff. There could have been a lot of fun takeoffs on this.
We do see a significant amount of traction here though in the marketplace with recent discussions that started probably last week and now have probably taken off a lot more this week. With the decision, with now Dish wanting to potentially do a deal with Aereo. And we'll see. A lot of the writing out there says that this is just Dish's way of putting pressure on some of its some of the networks with whom they have expiring contracts coming up. You could see already that that Dish may be seeing a way around having to pay all the retransmission fees if they do a deal with Aereo, which is a wonderful additional revenue stream for Aereo if that actually happens, if it's not just a negotiation ploy. The other thing to think about here is that retransmission fees, as I think probably we all saw in looking at articles on this case, is they're fairly new. And so I think the thought there is that the networks have been able to live without these fees up until only a few years ago. So showing significant damage may be maybe, not tenuous, but it's not saying that this has been like this way for years and years and years.
I've got to just go ahead and confess that when you start talking about cable regulations and things like retransmission fees, it is one area of the law where I just completely glaze over. And it's really, really hard for me to get my head around, you know, who has to pay what. And so I'm going to ask, and I'm not expecting anyone to know the answer to this because I don't. But who does, Jamie, have to pay retransmission fees in the way that the networks want Aereo to pay them here?
So right now, as it's currently set up, if you have Comcast, you have Fios, you have AT&T, Uverse, it's all those companies that are paying fees. They have deals with the various networks, ABC, NBC, Fox, and then they also have their deals with the cable networks, which are not really impacted by this because those aren't free transmission anyways. So in one of the articles that I read, we're talking about Dish's soon to be expiring contract with Disney. And obviously there's a significant amount of programming that comes from Disney, ABC. And again, so back on the possible negotiation ploy in making public some of the discussions they're having with Aereo. But also very funny is they're resisting all, not funny, but interesting is they're resisting all information requests, which are coming in the form of subpoenas right now, from all the networks, to disclose the nature of those discussions with Aereo.
Greg Sandoval writing over at Verge, has a great article with Aereo's CEO, Chet Kanogia, where he has a bunch of quotes and is characterized as taking a very stoic approach to this interim victory that they've gotten. It's definitely a good thing that they're able to stay in business, but he recognizes that it's going to be a long fight. And he talks, too, about what you've been mentioning, Jamie, that he says there's a ton of inbound interest in the company. There are a lot of people who want to work with us. So I'm sure that's true, and Dish would be a good candidate for that kind of thing. So this will be a very interesting company to watch, both in and out of the courtroom. Margo, anything further on Aereo before we move on?
No, I got to say rabbit ears, so I'm good.
Good. Evan, any small woodland creatures you'd like to invoke?
No, only the consumer, I guess. You know, let's hope that if entities can save on retransmission fees, they're of course going to pass that savings on to the consumer, right? The end user and all this. I'm not going to hold my breath, but you know, it could happen.
All right. So let's move from the realm of watching and consuming entertainment to the realm of who might be watching you and talk about some privacy concerns. So before we get into a serious discussion, I have to say that the funniest, and maybe this is just my own twisted sense of humor, April Fool's stuff that I saw, one was from Microsoft. And these are the folks that have Do Not Track On by default in their IE browser. Over at the official Microsoft blog, posted by Frank Shaw, their corporate vice president of corporate communications at Microsoft, has a wonderful post about the Do Not Track suit that you put on, and it's going to protect you in the real world from folks who want to track you. Let's see. There's some really funny stuff in here. What the consumers would really like, they're recognizing, is the ability to game the system to their advantage. Instead of simply preventing yourself from being tagged, why not substitute an image or a tag of your choosing? When someone tries to check you in at a bar, why not replace it with a check-in at the library? If a friend tags you at a Justin Bieber concert, why not switch it to the Black Keys? So. They are definitely thinking ahead there at Microsoft. And then the other really funny thing was, I guess it's the Effector that EFF publishes that has their, you know, roundup of things. And they're their April Fool's one was hysterical, including Trevor Tim's update on drones, which is just called in drones today, drones, according to EFF activist Trevor Tim, drones and drones, drone, and nano drones. So
I think that might have I think that might have been his April Fool's comment last year, too.
Oh, was it?
So at least he's consistent.
It goes on. But, you know, moving from Trevor being funny, he does some very serious coverage of the issue of surveillance drones. And Margo has been paying attention to that, too. It seems like we're now in the situation where all of the 50 states are looking at this and scrambling to put something in place. Where do things stand now, Margo?
Oh, boy. So basically, there are roughly 30, maybe a couple more than 30 states at this point that are considering anti-drone legislation. And the kinds of legislation fall into two categories. One deals with law enforcement, and the other deals, a much smaller segment, deals with civilian use of drones. And most of the concerns have to do with surveillance from drones, for the most part, addressing video surveillance or photographic surveillance. And they're kind of, well, there are significant differences and significantly different implications for banning or restricting law enforcement use of drones and banning or restricting civilian use of drones. So that's part of what I'd like to talk about a little bit.
So it seems like, and you sent us a link, that the Missouri House had just endorsed a ban. It seems like the legislatures are either taking the path of, we're going to prevent this kind of surveillance with this kind of technology outright, or we're going to make law enforcement at least get a warrant. Missouri seemed to be in the former category, correct?
Yeah, Missouri actually includes or has included in a bill that the House, I think, has just approved, but hasn't obviously enacted yet. They're addressing media use of drones for the surveillance of individuals. And they do include an exception for the surveillance of individuals in public places. But the surveillance of individuals in non-public places is banned by this particular proposed bill.
Got it.
So to give an idea of why that's problematic, if you think about any sort of public figure who doesn't want to end up on the news without their permission, this gives them an enormous advantage once commercial drone use is allowed, which it's not yet. They'll be able to, in Missouri, say, you don't get to follow me if I'm not in a public place.
Okay. Do you see any of the states paying attention to the types of drones being used? Is there any concern that the really, really tiny ones are the problematic ones? If you can see it, maybe you can deck it.
No, there doesn't seem to be much distinction between different kinds of drones. You could sort of say that, so states have existing privacy laws, and this is also why I think that states are better equipped to handle balancing privacy and the First Amendment than the federal government necessarily is. In state privacy laws, there's usually some kind of reference to a reasonable expectation of privacy, and there's often reference to whether or not the recording is surreptitious. So a number of states have all-party consent wiretap laws that require some sort of notice to the people being recorded. And if you haven't been found to give notice, or you've been doing it surreptitiously, then you may be violating a state all-party consent wiretap law if you're making an audio recording, right? This is not video recording, but it could be very analogous in the drone context.
Evan, are you looking forward to a world where all the states have different restrictions and you may be surveilled in one and not in another? And, you know, does it matter that we're moving toward sort of a chaotic legal landscape that way?
Well, that wouldn't be anything different than the way that privacy regulation is done today. It's called a patchwork, you know, a lot of different forms of regulation. So, I mean, there's no better time than the present to try to make this more uniform, because if it is, you know, like a state-to-state thing like you're talking about here, that's only going to compound the problems that there are now with As Margaret was pointing out, you know, there are different state eavesdropping laws. For example, some states require two-party consent, some only require one. So with this technology, may very well come an exponential growth in the ability for its use. And, you know, especially if the drones get evolve into something that we don't even really think about. I don't know about you, but when I think of drones, the first image that comes into my mind is still kind of like a pretty good-sized military aircraft. Mm-hmm. That, you know, several feet wingspan. But, you know, as these things get very small, and I know that we were circulating that image today, I think the authenticity of it may be somewhat in dispute, but like that mosquito-sized and mosquito-shaped drone, you know, right. Whether that exists, and those who are watching on video now see it on the screen, you know, whether that exists now, you know, regardless of whether that technology exists now, there's no reason to think that that's implausible, that just in a very relatively short period of time, little machines, little transponders like that will be almost literally in the air around us, the air we breathe perhaps with nanotechnology. So that's where the concern really comes, because with that increase in pervasiveness, that's going to exacerbate any kind of inconsistency that there is in the law. So you know, despite the downsides of seeing federal regulation on something like this, it may be a good, you know, that any downside to a federal regulation of this may be outweighed by the interest in seeing that there really are Fourth Amendment concerns baked into any kind of regulatory framework, and just the very fact that it would be consistent across our nation rather than having a mix and match where you go. Because what are you going to do if you send, you know, for example, a little mosquito-sized drone from Kentucky into Tennessee and they have different regulatory frameworks? You know, how are you going to handle that? So we might as well have some consistency. That would be a good thing.
You're going to swat it is what you're going to do.
That's right.
So can I have a 2-second response to that?
Yes.
So I think that on the Fourth Amendment front, right, on laws governing law enforcement, it totally makes sense to have a federal law and have that relatively soon, because we have a tradition of regulating law enforcement through federal legislation, and it's around time that we updated our federal privacy legislation anyway. On the governance of private drone use, I really do think the states are the way to start. You might end up creating a congressional bill that creates a, you know, a sort of a privacy floor that all states have to abide by that would be similar to an eavesdropping law or a video voyeurism law. But to try to figure out the right balance between the First Amendment rights of the person using the drone video and the privacy rights of the person being surveilled is going to be really, really tricky. There are a number of circuits that have been struggling with this. The First Circuit said you have a First Amendment right to record police. The Third Circuit said in public, and the Third Circuit said you don't. So I think it's a really difficult question. I don't think Congress is ready to weigh in on that yet.
That's probably safe to say.
I have a little concern about the reactionary nature of the proposed bills in all the states, because it seems like, you know, this is a big public issue that lawmakers want to score points with their constituents. So, you know, we're gonna protect you. And it seems like, you know, at least this Missouri one, for example, has captured a lot of activity, as you were saying, Margo, that you really don't need to control to make sure that people feel secure in their curtilage. That, you know, lawmakers or people criticizing the lawmakers are arguing, you know, my daughter taking a simple videotape on a weekend pleasure trip would be against the law. She's taken some video and observes a murder occurring. That evidence could not be allowed in a court of law under this law. So, and again, it's not real clear how the law would be applied. But, you know, I'm worried that lawmakers may be enacting things that are more sweeping than they need to be. Jamie, do you share my concern?
I certainly do. And I mean, I agree with all the reasons why we need to be protective of people in the privacy of their own homes when they have a reasonable expectation of privacy. But in reading a number of articles about all the positive uses that could be made here, and I mean, I think that's the overriding point. Rescue missions for purposes of firemen and women out there fighting fires to see how the stability of a building from up top, all those things should be considered. And it's really hard to consider all that in haste. So absolutely agree with you.
You know, Neal Stephenson is one of the first people to think up those little bug-sized drones. He called them aerostats in the Diamond Age, where Bud made himself scarce because the monitors, almond-sized aerostats with eyes, ears, and radios, had probably picked up the sound of the explosion and begun converging on the attack. Those little things buzz all around in that story. If you haven't read it, it's a good one.
When was that? What's that? What era was that written in? Is that fairly recent?
I would say it was probably, without looking it up, written in the early 90s. So I don't know. Let's see. IRC will probably correct me on that. But it's a great book and definitely has that kind of technology throughout it. It's all about, you know, what happens when nanotechnology is everywhere. So Margot, what about the distinctions between taking video and taking still pictures and recording audio? You know, are these the things that the states are going to be able to parse, you think, properly?
I think it's unlikely that they'll be parsed, in large part because existing privacy laws don't really distinguish that heavily between them. Mm-hmm. But I do think, again, this is the fact that they need to be parsed is an argument for having states figure them out, right? So if you have one state that addresses video but not audio and you have some horrific privacy violation that occurs, then the state will hopefully fix its law to end up including audio as well. Where if we have a federal statute and we don't let states play around with it, then you're stuck with the first try.
Right. Excellent point. Any other thoughts on this, Evan, before we move on?
No. It's a nice conversation. I'm ready to move on if you are.
We've had enough droney drones. Jamie?
No, I'm good here.
All right. Well, before we leave the privacy front, there is an interesting law pending in California that, you know, once we've gathered all this information about people, whether by drones or by monitoring their web activity, California wants to make that information available to the surveillees, and we're talking about private companies here, not law enforcement. This bill is seeking to give consumers access to their personal data that's being mined. It's called the Right to Know Act. And under it, you would be able to make a once yearly request to any company that is gathering data, and they would have to tell you, yes, this is what we have about you, and this is who we're sharing it with. And it has an interesting twist to it. It gives companies the option, since this would obviously be expensive and would require a lot of administration to respond to these requests. And it says, well, you know, if you don't want to have to comply with this law, you just don't have to collect data on people, and then you're in good shape. So, Margot, do you think that this law has a good chance of passing, and will California lead the way for other states?
I hope it does. I don't know. You know, it's not something that I think businesses would be particularly excited about. But on the other hand, it's a once a year burden per individual. And California has really been a leader on privacy laws nationally. So this might give California an opportunity to be a leader in this space, too. I think the exciting thing about this law, it's actually a complement to drone laws, right? Because if you allow private companies to surveil, whether it's online or it's through video, you want to be able to figure out what exactly they're doing. And this provides one element of what are referred to as fair information practices. It allows people who are being watched to know what exactly has been gathered on them. The sort of next step is allowing people who have been watched to correct that information or change that information if they find that it hurts them in some way. But I think this is a good first step.
Right. That was not me smoking the cigarette outside the strip bar. No, not me at all. Jamie, what do you think of this law?
Well, this law is actually an expansion of a law that comes up in our practice quite a bit. And expansion is kind of an understatement, given the current law is California's SB 27 law, which was passed several years ago and gave already in place, and it's been for years, gives consumers the ability to contact a company to ask them with whom that company has shared information with third parties for marketing purposes. From what I understand, based on a number of clients getting into compliance with this when it was passed, the requests for such information are few and far between. Again, it's California residents only, but in any event, the requests have been few and far between. And up until last year, the enforcement of that law has been extremely few and far between. There had been some audits a few years ago done by some people as to whether companies were actually complying with the requests. And but that was about it until about a year ago, a year and a half ago, maybe, when a number of lawsuits were filed against a number of California companies collecting information from California residents. Most of those lawsuits were dismissed for lack of showing of damages, because there was an alleged failure to comply. I believe there's a couple still pending. But in any event, this new law, without getting overly verbose here on my response, is it's such a huge expansion. It speaks to both what that company is storing and disclosing, and is not restricted to marketing data at all. So I'm seeing a significant pushback from the lobbying efforts of everyone in Silicon Valley on this.
Evan, do you agree? I mean, it is going to be a really, it seems like, potentially onerous burden on companies, or maybe not, you know, if the word never gets out about this and people aren't that anxious to find out what's going on. What do you think?
Well, it's pretty easy to see both sides of the argument on this. Clearly this, I mean, there's no doubt that this is an onerous requirement on businesses, not only to actually comply, but to just also kind of live with the threat of some kind of enforcement for failure to comply with all the things that need to be said and done with all this. But, you know, at the same time, there is an important privacy interest. And I think there's a third vector going into all of this is, you know, what's the effect of this going to be on innovation? If the net effect is this is going to be that companies collect less information, there's less value to be derived then from the information that's there. And, you know, is there going to be the incentive to innovate like there would be if there weren't as much information? You know, it's a big data question, I guess like that. So, you know, I, of course, agree with what Jamie says, that this is, you know, a big expansion. And, you know, I think that kind of presents the question of whether or not it truly is needed. And, you know, we certainly should not understate the effect that this would have, the increase in costs in doing businesses for companies in this space. It's not self-evident how that argument can be well made.
I get all that, but I like the fact that it encourages companies to think about the fact that people care about this information and really, you know, have an interest in making sure that they're not being just sort of harvested and used for commercial financial purposes. I like the law for that reason. I know that there will be economic fallout and that there, you know, it may wind up operating as a tax on business in a way that is not a great thing. But I do like the notion of incentivizing businesses the way that it does and giving consumers this option. What I fear is that, as with credit reports, a whole third party kind of sleazy market, not that I am at all maligning businesses that don't deserve to be maligned, but I don't know if you've ever attempted to get your credit report and come into contact with the layer of businesses out there that, you know, for a small fee that will keep charging you over and over and over again, will keep monitoring, you know, all three credit reporting companies and send you reports and stuff. I mean, it really is kind of a racket, these businesses that are attempting to get you the information that, you know, you could get yourself for free if you weren't channeled into their marketing and sales platforms. Margo, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. One way of looking at the cost on this is that it taxes businesses. The other way is to say that it actually makes more apparent to consumers the cost that they are paying. So if, you know, my online social network, mebook.com, is effectively free because I'm selling MeBook Me, then I should know what exactly it is that I, as a consumer, am exchanging in return for the free service.
But what are you going to do about it? You know, what power does the consumer have to really respond one way or the other, you know, given this knowledge?
It's possible that paid services that don't gather quite as much information might end up arising. And it's also possible that I might just choose not to share as much information. And I think the fact that this is occurring in a situation, my understanding of the bill is that it applies to companies that aggregate information across different platforms. It also provides a great deal of notice to consumers about how much their online behavior accumulates in one place, right?
Yeah. Let me jump in here and say that we're spending a lot of time talking in the industry about accurate and comprehensible privacy policies. And, you know, part of this new or the amended proposed law gets to that, which is the part about telling us what you what you're storing about us. My thought on that is maybe there's really not a need to expand SB 27 to beyond, you know, disclosing what people are sharing for marketing purposes, because we already have in California in particular, a law that says you have to have a privacy policy that discloses what you're collecting.
Right.
And why not just explain what you're storing? I mean, we've gone round and round over the years with all sorts of companies disclosing, changing their data retention policies. So I really question the need for that portion of the amendment to apply to what people are holding on to.
Yeah, but nobody reads those, Jamie.
Yeah, right? They're...
Of course.
It's true, but it's a lot easier than calling the company and asking them to send you something. You can just go online and read it. I'm not saying they're always accurate or they're comprehensible, but given that there's so much focus on that today, without needing to pass a law, let's focus on that.
So to push back on that, a lot of people in the Freedom of Information Act space will contact the federal government and file a Freedom of Information Act request to get as much information as the government has on them as exists in different agencies. And I think that the idea of a person being able to go to a company and say, basically, I want you to do the equivalent of a FOIA and give me what you have on me, is very appealing. And the fact that individuals will do this in the FOIA context shows to me that they would be interested in doing it in the private context as well. And a privacy policy is not equivalent to that. A privacy policy says, this is what we're doing. It doesn't allow for negotiation, and it doesn't give you feedback on what is actually being stored.
This is kind of funny, but it seems like at least in companies where they have had to, under the DMCA, add a whole compliance team to deal with notice and takedown requests, maybe those same people could just be assigned, you know, get a little bump in pay, and they could also be the right to know compliance team as well. So,
sure. Who's going to pay for that bump in pay? It's the consumer. You know, it all is going to translate into just higher prices or whatever. Or people are going to flee Facebook, is what you're suggesting, Margo. You know, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think is that a bad thing? You've fled Facebook, Evan.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I guess I did. I guess
I'm the
so, hypocrite.
No, I mean, it would be you know, a way of enlightening people, I think, with perhaps more force than a privacy policy that says this is what the kind of thing that we're going to do. When you look at instead a report that says this is everything we have on you, it has a bit more force.
Right. It does have the force. And I would just, you know, I think the FOIA metaphor is a good one. I think it's valid, but I think there may be some point where we could question how you know, isomorphic it is in the private context, because the government has much more of a power, you know, to compel someone to do something, much greater power, the police power that it could exercise over them. So it'd be much more of a compelling reason to want to know what the government has on you than it would a company. But that, you know, perhaps is just kind of a separate, you know, principle based on the individual sensibility of a person. So,
and I guess what would be really interesting to see is if someone tried to construe the amendment to apply to anything that was ever connected to personal information. That would be an extremely difficult task.
Give us an example, Jamie.
online behavioral advertising may through the collection of that data across different websites tie some information to a person. But that information standing alone, of course, it means nothing. So the question is, if I make a FOIA type request to Google, and they know my name, they know my address, they know my phone number, they know my email address, but they also know that I like Led Zeppelin. Do they have to disclose that they know that I like Led Zeppelin? Or do they just have to disclose all the personal information they have for me? I think reading the law right now, it's just the personal information they have for me. But I could see people construing it a different way, just as we've gone down the road with, okay, well, now IP address could be deemed personal information in some contexts.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Margo, do you think that the Act would encompass, behavioral kinds of information?
I was actually going to bring up the IP address and personally identifiable information as well. I'm honestly not sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. And I think you're right, Jamie. People could argue it on both sides. Hopefully the lawmakers will get a handle on that as they're hashing through drafts of this legislation.
One related point to that, there was a study that just came out, I think it was this week, about how individuals through four different points of cell phone data, location data, can be identified. I think it's up to 95% of individuals can be personally identified based on four different points of cell phone location data. So the idea of what is personally identifiable may be much, much broader than what most people think. So maybe the "you like Led Zeppelin" point won't be personal info, but where you were last week could be personal info.
Right. Evan, you brought that up last week, I think. And this law apparently has a provision in it allowing companies, if they're not able to comply with the Act due to limited resources or other circumstances, they can choose not to store unnecessary data. That's the "just don't track us." Or ensure that any data collected would de-identify users before storing and sharing it. And making that happen is, as Margo says, maybe not as easy as it sounds.
Right. And even if we think we know what de-identification means, I mean, with advancing processing power, the obfuscation of stuff becomes, much more scrutable with, stronger algorithms. So, I'm prima facie suspect of de-identification in a lot of contexts just because of the science. I'm thinking about the works of Paul Ohm, who I've brought up on the show several times before. He has some really compelling reasons and arguments why de-identification is certainly not always everything it's cracked up to be.
All right. Well, I'm tempted to make scrutable our MCLE, our second one for the show, but instead I think I'll do Right to Know because people might not recognize scrutable or might spell it wrong, and then we'd all be embarrassed. Right. So let's make it Right to Know is our second phrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And the reason we're dropping phrases into the show for you to jot down is in case you're in a jurisdiction where your compliance board wants you to demonstrate, yes, in fact, I listened to this show, and now you have a couple of ways of showing them that you did. So let us move on and talk about, this is kind of interesting. It's sort of a follow on to our Aaron's Laws discussions on the show. The EFF has sort of picked up and emphasized the fact that lots and lots of websites have terms in their terms of use provisions that say that you must be over the age of fill in the blank, 13, 18, to use this site. And in many, many instances, people using that site are under that age. So Trevor Tim and Dave Mass over at EFF have pointed out that if you are a youngster reading news online, it may be that you are running afoul of those terms of service. If you're on the CNN site, or let's see, they give some examples. I'm not sure if CNN has that or not, but they do give the example of the Houston Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, Popular Mechanics, on all those sites, you have to be at least 18 years old to use the site under the terms. NPR has been a bit more savvy. It looks like if you're between the ages of 13 and 18, you may browse the NPR services, et cetera, so long as you do not submit any user materials. So what Trevor and Dave's point is here is, and this is their headline, are you a teenager who reads news online? According to the Justice Department, you may be a criminal. So this is all part of their effort to get people to pay attention to reforming the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Evan, do you think that this is a problem? I mean, clearly there are tons of websites out there that have these provisions in their terms.
No, I don't think it's a problem. And I think that reality kind of informs us that it's not a problem. You know, this is like an issue we talk about every week, it seems like. You know, violating the terms of service is going to put you in jail for 30 years for violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, IRC and the world at large, but I think there's been one criminal prosecution, and that was later overturned by the judge, based on violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for someone violating the terms of use, and that was the Lori Drew case, and that those were some pretty egregious facts where a girl was dead because of what Lori Drew was alleged to have done. So, you know, Trevor Tim, he's awesome. And, you know, I think he's brilliant and all that stuff. But I honestly don't see what the, you know, why he's droning on like this. Did I really say that?
About this issue?
Because, I mean, clearly the reason that, you know, it's ha-ha funny, but the reason that these terms of service say what they say is because of, you know, thing that's very hardwired into contract law. These service providers don't want to be entering into voidable contracts with people who aren't of majority in their age of jurisdiction. So they say that for a very sound legal reason. So, you know, if people were getting convicted left and right and sent to prison for violating website terms of service, I would say, yeah, this is a problem of utmost concern for our age and of our generation, whatever. But, you know, it's, to me, it seems like a solution looking for a problem. At the same time, let me say that I think the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and I think I say this every week, you know, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act does have its problems. Reform is necessary. But this is, I mean, come on. To be honest, I think it's a little bit sophomoric to be continuing to harp on this thing. You could violate the terms of service and you're going to go to jail for 36 years. And, you would have been there with Aaron Swartz and all that stuff. I just don't get it. And I don't think it's as big of a deal as what people are making it here.
Well, it's a little bit parallel to the situation we were discussing at the top of the show, where it's just something that is a fact of life. In the case of how the Copyright Act treats digital copies, and there's just not that much that can be done about it because of the way that the laws are drafted. We've got people putting this language in their terms of service, terms of use, to be able to comply with federal privacy laws regarding children. And they really don't have much choice, but it leads to these sort of absurd situations where wink, wink, nod, nod. Yes, we know you're going to read the news on our site, but we have to say that that's not allowed unless you're 18 years old. Does that seem like sort of a strange situation to be in, Margo?
Yeah. I mean, to push back a little bit against what Evan said, sorry, Evan. I think that the big issue here is criminal penalties, right? So we're trusting in prosecutors to not enforce against these ridiculous scenarios. And for the most part, prosecutors are good and decide not to enforce the law against the 13-year-old who reads NBC. But the point of providing that example as something that a prosecutor could go after is that arbitrary enforcement creates real problems when most of your population could be subject to a criminal law. And so I think one of the things EFF has really been pushing for is to move punishments for terms of service violations out of criminal law entirely into civil law and make those punishments much more proportionate, so that you don't risk, in doing a behavior that everybody does or everybody in your demographic does, you don't risk being prosecuted for it.
Okay, Evan, you have anything else to?
Well, fair enough. I don't understand why so many millions of brain cycles and so many pixels are being expended on discussion of the issue when it seems like this should be, you know, pretty far down on the list. And I'm just looking at reality. There are essentially no prosecutions over this. You know, even Aaron Swartz was, did a lot more, actually taking documents, doing a lot more. He was much more than just misrepresenting him, like his physical appearance on OkCupid or something like that. You know, he was actually doing something that inarguably is much greater than just, misrepresenting or accessing a site when he was 17 instead of 18 or something like that. I'm just calling for a reality check is all.
This doesn't have anything to do with whether or not the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act should be reformed. But did you guys see that documents have come out as part of the legal battle between Aaron Swartz's family and the government over releasing sealed documents in the case, as reported by David Kravitz at Wired, that the prosecutors, including Carmen Ortiz and Stephen Heyman, have been pretty heavily harassed for their roles in the case. Various harassing and threatening messages, a postcard of Mr. Heyman received a postcard with a picture of his father's head in a guillotine. So I don't know. I mean, maybe it's indicative of how unpopular their actions were and the law is, but not a very nice way to express it. Jamie, any thoughts on all this?
I echo a lot of what Evan said, and I, I just want to reiterate that the reason why these ages that are in there at all has to do with the contracting with minors, not really a privacy issue. I think that the privacy issue really comes up in the context of users under 13 and the collection mm-hmm. of information, which really doesn't come into play in a terms of use per se, and so. But I also agree that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act should be reformed. I kind of liked some of the stuff that I hear Eric Goldman saying on his proposed reforms, removing the criminal penalties from all but some very egregious acts, and turning it more into a little bit of a little bit more like a DMCA or CDA type situation, where you're putting the onus on the website proprietors to ensure that their terms of use are written appropriately and are receiving the correct consent, putting those things in there, making sure that the website proprietors are jumping through relevant hoops to be able to enforce from a contract perspective their terms of service, as opposed to relying on the CFAA for it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I wish there were a way we could create some elected or appointed position where Eric Goldman could just be in charge of reviewing the various laws on the books and shaping them up. That would be a really, really good thing. Great for the country in so many ways.
I'll second that. Yeah.
Yes.
For sure.
All right. Well, let us move on then to something Jamie has been paying a lot of attention to and that we talked about a bit on last week's show. And that is the fact that the FTC has updated its disclosure guidelines, has a bunch of examples for how one should do disclosure. Jamie, give us some practical advice here, knowing that a lot of our audience is very active online. What do people have to take care of?
Well, I think, as the FTC would put it, and I kind of agree with this, that the law hasn't changed. This is an update to .com disclosure guidelines that were put out in 2000, and obviously a lot's changed since then. The small screen is ruling. Small space communications are ruling the day, and that really wasn't contemplated all that much in 2000. And so a couple of different things didn't change, and that's that you need to make things in clear and conspicuous manner. You can't lie. You have to disclose your material connections. If a blogger is being paid by someone, you need to disclose that. That is not actually part of the .com disclosure guidelines. That's part of the endorsement guides. Although there were a number of examples in the updated guides about endorsements, because there are disclosures that come with them. I want to also say that these new guides do not apply offline per se. It's all about advertising, digital advertising. Another kind of background piece is, and I got this question a lot from clients right when this updated guides came out, because they called it digital advertising guides. And I mean, clients and, you know, even lawyers in the space are confused on this issue. And that is, what is advertising? And I will just put it very clear, very simply, that it's not, does not have to be paid. It has to be when the company is talking about themselves, or when someone is talking about them, about that company on behalf of that company, when there's a connection. And so I think a lot of people got immediately kind of a little warm and fuzzy feeling inside. Oh, well, if it's paid advertising, that's going to be a lot easier. It's not going to apply so much, but that's wrong. It applies statements on your webpage, on your homepage. It applies to tweets. It applies to advertisements in mobile apps. It applies to communications in mobile apps. And it applies to, you know, communications via text message, whatever. And so the practical advice here is a little unfortunate. The FTC came out and said, if you can't make a disclosure given the space constraints of the platform on which you're working or using, don't use that platform. I think that is somewhat inherent in just general advertising law, but no one really wanted the FTC to put that in the guides. But they said it, and we have to deal with that. I think another real kind of important takeaway, and we can get into some of the more nitty-gritty, is that some of the current practices between year 2000 and now, the way in which advertisers were attempting to make adequate disclosures, are specifically not acceptable by the FTC. For example, one of the things that even I was doing with some of my clients was advising that if you were going to make an advertisement that required a disclosure in a tweet, that you would end that tweet with something like "see next tweet" in like text speak, and then the next tweet would have another 140 characters of awesome legal language. They specifically said not acceptable, for reasons that you know we you know you give a risk assessment to a client for reasons that were somewhat anticipated. You know, that second tweet could easily become separated from the first tweet. There's no requirement that there's not going to be someone else tweeting in between those two tweets using the same hashtag, for example. So I'll stop there. I have a lot more to say on it, but I'll let someone else talk for a few minutes and we can come back.
Margo, do you think that these restrictions about disclosures are too onerous, or do you think they're a good thing?
I mean, my first thought was Twitter. I can't figure out for the life of me how you would end up being able to make commercial speech on Twitter and not violate these. So maybe Jamie can inform me.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's a number of different ways of advertising. Some advertising doesn't require a disclosure. Advertising that does require a disclosure, where the disclosure is not so important, like health and safety information or pricing information that is avoidable. Meaning, for example, you know, buy one get one free. And then you find out that it ends in 3 minutes, but you have to go to the store, and you could stop right there and go to whatever it is, the Gap, as opposed to it being an online only offer. Those things, you're just not going to be able to do on Twitter very easily. But the good part of the disclosure guides that came, the updated disclosure guides, is that they allow for linking in certain situations to disclosures, as long as that link is appropriately placed in the tweet, for example. Twitter's not the only area of impact here, but in the tweet, and that the link is titled appropriately. So things like legal, important, terms, all not acceptable. So the link has to really tie back to the claim being made and really has to invite people to go and look at it.
How about disclosure? Does that work?
No. No.
Too bad.
If it was, for example, something about an important pricing, a pricing disclosure, or you know that you couldn't somehow fit in ends tomorrow, then the name of the link would need to say something along the lines of end date or something something like that. Very descriptive, and letting people and making it look like a link. I mean, people fell in love with Bitly. and all the tiny URLs that are out there. And it's just not an acceptable approach anymore, because those are kind of, you know, a string of letters that don't mean anything in an advertising law perspective.
So wait, are you saying that the link actually has to convey something meaningful in whatever characters it's using?
Yes, or the word right before it needs to.
I see.
And it has to be an invite to click. But people were relying on the fact that there was a link that, you know, would say buy one, get one free at the Gap or whatever. These are really innocuous kind of claims, but, you know, lose 10 pounds or whatever it is. And at the end, it would just say, you know, bit.ly/49394. No one knows why you have to click on that. There's no, there's no description. And things as generic as disclosure terms, legal, all not going to be acceptable anymore.
Evan, I don't know. I mean, obviously it's something that people need to pay attention to, but my concern is that the Kardashians have good legal counsel, and they're going to be able to figure out how to convey that their tweet about how wonderfully the mascara makes their lashes long is sponsored by Maybelline. That they're going to be able to know how to do that. Do you think the mom and pop bloggers out there who may have sponsors that they're getting the word out about, are they going to be as ably represented?
I lose sleep at night worrying about what the Kardashians are going to do about this. You know, this was the first thing I thought of when it came to that. So, well, I mean, I think just hearing Jamie talk about these things and showing how, first of all, how nuanced they are, and also how surprising the end result is. I mean, when I think, you know, myself included, and I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way, kind of feel surprised that the FTC is really requiring so much from all this. So I think it's inevitable that there's going to be difficulty in that compliance. There's going to be a learning curve. And I suspect that is with so many things where it's sometimes not perfectly clear on the surface of things how to do the right thing. There's going to be a learning curve and hopefully some patience on the part of the FTC and you know, as people get up to speed on all this. So yeah, it's not clear, like I said, right off the bat how to do this, and it'll take some time.
All right. I can't let our advertising lawyer Jamie jump off the show without addressing the fact that Amazon, did you see this, Amy, defended an ad that was this an automatically displayed ad, perhaps, that showed up on its site that used the C word in its text? It was
This was in the UK.
Greeting card. Yes, it was in the UK. Yeah, where, so yes, anybody who has watched, you know, the International Ad Awards knows that Europe has a different sensibility about what they will put on TV and advertisements than, and in print, I assume, than the United States does. But this was something where a picture of a Christmas card that said, called mum a very bad word, and then, oops, sorry, meant to say Merry Christmas. Amazon actually defended that ad and called it humorous and not in everybody's taste. Any thoughts on this from the legal perspective, Jamie?
Well, you know, it wouldn't necessarily have been problematic in the U.S., but the ASA, which is a you know, the advertising standards in the U.K., has a problem with these types of ads all the time, and so I'm this is not a shocker to me whatsoever. Anything a little racy goes off the air quickly in the UK. But they all, you know, the ASA to me is a little bit out of control the past year. Given I don't know if anybody has, you know, flipped through kind of the top 10 ads that were banned in the UK over the past year, but one of them is a kind of a competitor ad. It's not racy. It's not sexual. It's nothing. It's about that new SodaStream. which everyone is raving about. It's the ability to make your own soda in a much healthier manner, in a much more eco-friendly manner in your own home. You're not wasting bottles, you're not wasting cans, and in what I believe to be kind of a somewhat of a legitimate competitor ad, where they bash a little bit, Coca-Cola bottlers, Pepsi bottlers. The ASA said it was too aggressive, and they made them take it down. So I'm a little shocked, and I think sometimes the ASA a little bit overprotective. In that one, it seemed like the ASA was really rooting for Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and a number of other bottlers. But in any event, that's about all.
All right. Thank you for clarifying that. I think it's about time that we moved on to our tip and resource of the week. Again, on the subject of Twitter, this is something that was sent my way on Twitter. And I just want to take a moment to thank all the people who send me great information on Twitter about stuff that they'd like to see on the show. You know who you are. You do it all the time. Thank you so much. I am at D Howell on Twitter for folks who want to throw things in my direction. And this came to us that way. And it was a tweet from the support team at Twitter just advising people, hey, heads up, blocking an account does not make your profile private. Blocked users will still be able to visit your timeline, which then resulted in a flurry of user comments saying, what do you mean blocked users can still see my profile? And if you go to Twitter support, they're very clear about what blocking means and what it doesn't mean. And then when you post things publicly on Twitter, anybody, including blocked users that you have blocked, can see those things. They can't subscribe to you. They can't follow you. But that doesn't mean they can't go to twitter.com/your username and see exactly what you've been writing. So that is our tip. If you had any sort of misunderstanding about what blocking does for you from the privacy standpoint, it does not keep blocked users from seeing what you post. Those things say that they're public, and they are public.
That's the way Flickr works as well, by the way. Mm-hmm. With Flickr, if you block someone, they can still see your photo stream. So in that sense, it's kind of the same tip would just be applied to that.
Right. Denise, I don't know if you noticed that the first response to that comment was from the youngest Kardashian sisters. The two Jenner sisters.
Kendall and Kyle Jenner. That's really funny. yes, and it was off topic too. They say, I have a question. Can you follow for DM? Maybe they're just trolling for followers. And the one true Bix, who is someone I know from way back in the blogging days of yore, asks, when did that change? I don't think it, he says, there was definitely a period during which I could not view profiles of users who'd blocked me. So poor Bix has been blocked. So I guess maybe there was a change. But this is how it works now. Public posts are public posts, and all someone has to do is take the extra step of going to your profile to see what you have posted publicly. So if you have things, what a lot of people in this comment stream have asked is, can we fine-tune this? Can posts be public for some people and not for others? Sort of getting into the circles and friends lists kind of dynamics that Google Plus and Facebook offer. So maybe Twitter will listen and try and tweak things so that that will happen. But for right now, public posts are public, and it doesn't matter if you've blocked someone. What else? Our resources of the week are twofold. Number one, there's going to be Warren Allen of the Legal Hackers in New York is great about letting me know when they're going to have events, and they have a good one coming up. This is going to be on April 11th, 6:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. In New York. It is Internet Everywhere, the Role and Policy Implications of Public Wi-Fi in New York City. They're going to have a great panel moderated by our friend Nilay Patel. So definitely check that out if you're in the New York area. And then Warren also said, listening to our show last week when we were talking about having Jamie on and talking more about FTC compliance, he points us to a company called Comply.ly, available online at cmp.ly. Jamie, are you familiar with these folks?
I'm very familiar with those folks, and I know their founder and have chatted with him. It is a resource for purposes of disclosing endorsements and disclosing material connections. They've also brought into for purposes of disclosing necessary state required disclosures in sweepstakes advertising. So they've kind of been at the forefront of addressing all these endorsements, testimonials, and disclosure issues.
That's great. And Warren says they're built around ensuring companies comply with relevant FTC social media disclosures by means of short custom URLs that encode contextual information in the link. So that actually gets to what we were talking about whether your URL is just a series of numbers and letters or says something to your readers. So interesting. Check out Comply if you have a lot of sponsored tweets you need to be disclosing. All right. I think that's it for this episode of This Week in Law. It has been really, really fun. Some great stuff we've ranged over today. Margo, so great to meet you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
You can follow Margo on Twitter. She's Margo Kaminsky there. Margo, what's coming up at the Yale Information Society project that we should know about?
In a couple of weeks, we're having a panel on patent trolls, and a judge from the Federal Circuit will be attending, along with Jason Schultz and a couple of other people, Colleen Chen. And then at the beginning of May, we're having a workshop for people working in the area of First Amendment law. So I'm not sure that one's going to be particularly public-facing, but we'll have some exciting scholarship coming out of it for those of you who get excited by scholarship.
And who doesn't get excited by scholarship? Exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining us. You too, Jamie. It's been wonderful chatting with you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Jamie, I know you and Evan work together, but are you geographically nearby? Or I know your firm that's not necessarily a requirement of your firm.
That's accurate. It is not a requirement. But Evan and I happen to be close geographically. We are both in Chicago. We're both in Chicago. We see each other often. I hope he likes that. And
yes, I can pick that up from your Twitter handle, I guess, which is Chicago Ad Lawyer.
Yes.
So that's fantastic. It's been wonderful chatting with you today on the show. Thanks for all the good information.
Thank you.
And Evan, wonderful to see you as always.
Yes, I've really enjoyed it. Margo, really nice to meet you. Enjoyed our conversation. And Jamie, I just thought that was brilliant how you suggested that you may like Led Zeppelin to take the emphasis off the fact that you have Bieber fever so badly. So you get people thinking that you like something cool, actually. So a lot of fun hanging out with you in this context. So Denise, thanks for thanks for hosting a great show. It was a great time, and I'll look forward
to next
week.
Yes, that's just like gaming the system with the do not track suit.
Right.
So, yes. And
you should see all the Bieber stuff I have.
Yes.
There it is. It's the poster's just out of the frame, you know.
That's right.
I forgot to mention the do not track suit might be illegal under anti-mask laws, but that'll be for a future conversation.
All right. Wonderful. We will definitely bookmark that one. Hey, Evan, we need to get more of your colleagues on the show. Tanya has been on before, but you'll need to start lobbying because if they're anywhere near as good as Jamie, then we've got a good bullpen of guests to bring on then.
Yes, I am very fortunate to have wonderful colleagues like Jamie and Tanya and others. So yeah, let's keep it up.
Let's do it. All right. And we hope that you will keep on joining us every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, when we record the show live. But if you can't do that, you can find our whole archive of back shows at twit.tv/twill. We have our own YouTube channel at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We're right there in iTunes for you in all of our audio and video versions. And if you have the time and you've enjoyed the show, we'd appreciate it if you'd throw a review our way, or even if you haven't enjoyed the show, we'd love to hear from you, your feedback on the show in iTunes. That's very helpful. Next week, who do we have up next week, Evan? Oh, I don't even have my calendar up. It's just going to have to be a surprise for you guys. I guarantee you it's a great panel. And in a couple of weeks, we've got a very fun sort of multiverse meets robots panel coming up. So stay tuned for that on April 19th. Always good stuff here with the great guests who are gracious enough to come on the show, and our audience who feeds us such great stuff during the show and between the shows, for example, at our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thisweekinlaw, or over on Google Plus or on Twitter, as I mentioned before. So keep on doing it, and we will be here next week for you. Until then, we hope you have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.